minutes for this session, so we don't want to run really late. We have organized, well, the organizers of the conference have organized a number of sessions to talk about sort of breaking trends in various areas, and the SPEDTC has asked Rich Baranek to talk about some of the interesting things that are going on. You may have seen Rich getting the education award at the morning session on Monday, and we're definitely excited about that. He's doing some very, very interesting things, and we presume that some of you don't know about those things and will be interested to ask questions and talk about those things. We encourage you to raise your hand and ask a question. We're going to have some breaks, and I'm going to ask you. I also presume that some of you know about some things that are going on that we don't know about, and we definitely want to talk about those things. So to the degree that we get to talk a lot today about what's going on in education and what new things are happening and what you're working on and what we're working on, then this will be a success because we'll have gotten to share some new ideas. So, Rich, I will let you get started, and we'll just sort of stop every now and then and ask to, for you to comment and ask questions and toss out things that you might be aware of that we haven't talked about. So.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. Can you hear me okay in the back? So it's great to be here to talk a little bit about what the Signal Processing Education Technical Committee has been thinking about as far as emerging trends in signal processing education. As Wayne mentioned, some important caveats about today's talk is a lot of the things that we're going to at least present today are our opinions. And so it's very important in the breaks in between the various little subsections of the talk that you jump in with what you feel might be other trends, more interesting trends, or projects going on within these trends that are interesting. We're also interested in hearing about sub-trends, sub-sub-trends, and sub-sub-sub-trends. So the key issues that people are really starting to move from awareness to actual action about over the last few years are sort of listed up here. The first is the need to move towards a more learner-centric learning environments, meaning allow the curriculum to adapt to both the learner's level and also their context, and also really trying to transfer the responsibility of learning from the instructor to the student, right, to the learner themselves. A big problem with doing this is there's some roadblocks, right? The roadblocks related to the fact that the educational experience for too many kids today is very passive, right? We sit, we listen. What are we doing right now, right? We sit, we listen, we make notes. We go home and work on homeworks. It's a very inefficient way to teach and a very inefficient way to learn. One of the problems is when we try to do things differently, we end up with a roadblock of educational materials, be they lecture materials, textbooks, other materials that are very inflexible and have been very difficult to bring in more learner-centric or more active teaching philosophies. Okay? And finally, it's been people are starting to realize that they need to be thinking about how to bring a lot of the kind of experiences that we have from laboratories, hands-on experiences, into both the classroom and into the home studying of the student. And then people are also realizing that we might build a whole mechanism to attack these problems, but how are we going to put the stuff out there? How are we going to maintain it? And how are we going to ensure that quality remains high, right, and not degrades over time? So I'm going to talk about four trends that people have been moving into over the last couple years. And after I finish each one of these little trends, Wayne's going to hop up, right, and go ask people if they have any comments. So the first has to do with the idea of moving away from the standard paradigm of textbooks to more open source or free textbooks. Everybody knows about Wikipedia. How can we take ideas like this to other kinds of learning materials? And the key enablers of this are first that technology has come along in about the last two decades that have enabled us to rethink the textbook as instead of as a 600-page pile of paper, right, that's been glued together, to think about it instead as a collection of maybe smaller learning modules or learning objects that can be combined together in all kinds of different ways. So that instead of having the 600-page book, of which only 250 pages is used at any one of our institutions, except it's a different 250 pages, by doing things in this Lego block setting, setup, we can rapidly customize and reconfigure books. So there's just the perfect book for every one of our different classes. This would not be possible if it wasn't safe and easy to pull together these Lego blocks. And the other thing that's really moved forward in the last decade or so are open content licenses, things like the Creative Commons license, that make it really easy and also very safe to share content, very much like the GPL license really enabled the explosion of Linux and open source software. Quick show of hands, Creative Commons, how many people know about it? Okay, if you don't, you should write that down, creativecommons.org, and definitely check it out and join the movement. Last I checked, there are about 2 billion Creative Commons licensed works up on the internet. Okay, tremendous, tremendous movement. So one example is actually the project that we started at Rice 12 years ago called Connections, which is exactly this, a Lego-ized textbook publishing, authoring, and publishing environment. We currently have about 1,100 of these open textbooks in a whole bunch of different areas, from little kids' readers for 3-4-year-olds that are used in India, all the way up to postgraduate courses. Important thing is that these materials are from folks, authors worldwide, in about 40 different languages. And we're supporting right now roughly 2 to 3, depending on the month, million unique users per month coming to the site. So it's actually one of MIT OpenCourseWare and Connections are the two largest and most used open education sites. Just to give you an example of what it's like in Connections, all the materials are viewable as web pages. They're really fancy XML web pages right here. But they're also viewable via EPUB on your smartphone or your iPad, right? So you can carry them around or get them through iTunes U, for example. And everything is also available through a fancy print-on-demand engine that lets you pump out very professional quality print textbooks that you can see the price are hundreds of dollars, in some cases cheaper than competing textbooks, right? So that's basic idea behind Connections. There's just because it was started by signal processing people, there's a lot of content already in there in signal processing, actually several thousand modules already, and we'll come back around to this at the very end, that one of the purposes of this meeting is to get more of you involved in contributing materials. Wayne, you want to jump up? Or?
Sure. Okay, so has anybody got anything that they've just done in this?
Another one might be, topic du jour is Wikipedia, right?
How many of you have never heard of it? Connections before? Some of you found out about that today. That's good, right? So there's a whole lot of material out there. As Rich was saying, there's a lot of other open source resources out there. A lot of our students already know about Wikipedia. They jump right out there and say, let me find out about looking on Wikipedia. That one response to that has been, and this is ongoing discussion in the SPS society, is what can we do to make sure that the things that we care about are on Wikipedia and that the stuff that's out there is correct. Right? So there's been some effort to try to make sure that the things that are there are in fact valuable things that we would want to be there, and that there is an article on the FFT or future recognition or whatever it is that you care about.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
How many people here use Wikipedia regularly? Okay. For signal processing, like your work, not for, other stuff. Okay. How many of you have actually contributed or edited a Wikipedia entry? Okay, yeah. So I think that's one of the things that we need to do as a society, I think, is that the membership and the committees need to start generating higher quality Wikipedia entries for a lot of the signal processing content.
Figure out how to do.
A lot of us, I think, get to Wikipedia through Google.
Right.
So, since you're involved with Connections,
right?
How do you manage the interactions between the search engine providers, i.e. Google and Bing and Yahoo,
right,
and content on the site to you know, maximize exposure.
So that's so connections in particular, we have, like Wikipedia, we have a very high Google karma. So anything that's in connections ends up usually in the top three or so hits. That's just because there's so much linking, cross-linking that goes on. But we also do talk to Google regularly, and I'm actually going Tuesday to talk more with them. Yeah, in Mountain View. Yeah, good question. Yeah, one of the things that's really, really nice about open access materials on the web is you can get absolutely unbelievable amounts of use of your stuff. So Connection started 12 years ago when I was going to write a book. And instead of writing a book, I decided to do this, right? But I did put my book eventually into Connections, and it's been used about 5 million times, right? Which is sort of unbelievable to think about when you compare with what use you would have got from a print textbook. Yeah. Okay, so that's open education. Let's talk about video tutorials. Who knows about the Khan Academy? Show of hands. Okay, write it down. Khanacademy.org. There's this crazy guy, Sal Khan. I guess I will talk about him for just a minute. He is a former hedge fund manager who just started tutoring his cousins, his niece and nephew one day, remotely. And he started using software to tutor them. And they told their friends, and they told their friends, and they told their friends. He has turned into basically a monster of developing little 10-minute video tutorials on, basically, he wants to do it on everything. He has developed about 2,000 of these. He has a little studio that used to be in a closet in his house. It's now, he has a little office in Palo Alto, California. And he's developed 2,000 of these videos that cover basically everything technical in the K-12 curriculum. So like kids' education, and now he's starting to move into things. He's very excited to move into circuits, move into other areas. He is an unbelievable teacher. You might worry that, you know, are you going to lose your job to Sal Khan, right? So the idea of little video tutorials, little 6-minute, 7-minute, 10-minute tutorials on a concept, or on, for example, how to get started with LabVIEW, or how to get started in this lab, are tremendously powerful, both as to support distance learning for dealing with students who are not on your campus, also as time savings for training. A lot of people who have labs and are teaching kids about MATLAB or LabVIEW will use video tutorials in advance so that they don't have to go over the material in class. And then also really interesting ideas like reversed instruction. Anybody heard of reversed instruction? Where you basically put all of the lecture materials, right? You have a regular classroom setting, but all the lecture materials are available by videos. Students are expected to watch those in advance, and the only thing that goes on during the class is actual discussion and problem solving. Right? So Jeffrey Herman, who's a postdoc at University of Illinois, actually taught the UIUC DSP class using this system last summer, and it was tremendously effective, right? Tremendously effective. And he actually won the best paper award at SP Ed conference last year. So any comments or questions about this? Wayne, do you want to jump up? I know the Rose Holman folks have done a lot with videos to great effect. Any comments, Mark, Wayne?
I see it's mostly Ed Deering.
Certainly Ed Deering's done more of that than anybody else at Rose. But Battalion has done some, Deb Walter has done some. In any case, I just wanted to point out that upside down instruction model is something somebody just recently was asking, well, what should we do about students just, you know, sitting and texting in class? If I put a video out there, they don't even come, right? And the whole idea of the upside down classroom is that you basically give them the lecture for homework and then do the homework during your class time. And that way, you know, they need to be there to talk to you and they don't need to text and, you know, and
read the newspaper.
Read the newspaper during class because they need to get the homework done or they need to find out what's going on. So that's just another example of something where, you know, you can turn something where people are saying, well, you know, my students are not engaged in class into, well, then send them home to do that, right? And watch your lecture on YouTube. And and then spend that time in the room actually interacting, which is a little bit of what we're trying to do here, is to try to get some interaction going and say, you know, okay, you tell us what is going on instead of, you know, well, you
So how many people here have ever experimented with this kind of, as Wayne put it, upside down classroom or reversed instruction? Anybody here played around with it? I would expect we're all pretty traditional. Okay, so there are increasing numbers of experiments going on with this and increasing amount of evidence that this is a very, very highly effective way to teach. And the thing that's very difficult or challenging to all of you faculty out there is that it really cuts against the grain of what we're used to doing, which is going to the board, writing for an hour, and then having students write it down. But there was just a very interesting paper that came out in Science, I think the issue before last, by a group at UBC in Vancouver, where they actually showed an entire letter grade improvement in the class, the class outcomes, learning outcomes, by doing this basically reverse model. Jim?
So there's an effect, and I can't remember the name of it.
The Hodge?
But the effect basically says if you change...
Yes, if you change anything, grades will go up.
You will improve it.
Hawthorne effect, yeah, exactly. So the jury's still out. The jury is still out, absolutely. Okay. The last thing I'll say before moving on is this: doing this kind of thing used to actually be really hard. It was very hard, but tools now like Camtasia Studio, which you can, and some other tools, which are either very inexpensive or even in some cases free to use, are make it really, really quite easy to do this kind of thing. Right. So enough about video tutorials. The next is trying to bring the elements of the laboratory into the classroom, into the home study experience, into the homework, using interactive simulations. And the idea here is to move from a see culture, right, of printed text, more towards a do culture of actually interacting with different kinds of simulations. And there, as everyone knows, there's a number of different environments out there that folks are interacting with. We probably have missed several. But everything from LabVIEW to Mathematica, MATLAB to the free JDSP. There are also a number of other platforms that people are developing. And you can actually build extremely elaborate and very interesting simulations and examples that let people solve real-world kinds of problems in a very, very efficient manner. This is one of yours, right, Wayne? Or not Wayne, or Mark's, right? It's basically a convolution demo and a filter design demo that lets students get a handle on the parameters of all the various different filter structures, right? And I'm sure everybody here, we use MATLAB or LabVIEW or Mathematica, one of these tools. But what is coming is much, much easier ways to put these kind of simulations up on the web, making them live for your class to use and folks around the world to use. So any comments about this, interactive simulation? How many people here are using these in their class? Probably quite a few. Jim, did you have a comment? Or you were just...
I'm trying to get Mark to
make a comment. Okay, Mark, make a comment.
Which is, we were talking earlier, Mathematica.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's a, building anything like this, there's always a trade-off between look and feel and ease of construction. And all three of these sort of industry standard tools have different models for how to do this kind of thing, different ways to distribute them and put them up on the web. And so the jury is still out as far as which of these is the best, and a number of us are still actively experimenting with them, and I hopefully by the community working more and more with all of these will put pressure on these vendors to get even better, right? And then JDSP will take over the world, right?
If you want to put pressure on the vendors, I'm with MathWorks, so if you have anything you want to share with me, please come over and talk to me.
Fabulous. Right.
Some, that today and now, or is it coming?
So we have worked, so I'll just give you, yeah, so our personal experience is we have worked a lot over the years putting LabVIEW simulations in, and just due to, it's just become a little bit more tricky lately to put LabVIEW sims in, but people still are doing this. And we're also experimenting this summer. There now is a clear path to put Mathematica simulations directly into any web page, connections pages or any web page. And then you get into this trade-off that Jim kind of alluded to, that Mathematica looks like, at least today, it's constantly changing, at least today, it's the easiest to get to produce content to put into a web page, but it is by far the least flexible as far as look and feel and design. So feel free to talk with me after and I can fill you in more about that. But there is some pretty powerful and increasingly easy ways to do this kind of thing. Yeah. Well, and there are, and there's also some ways in MATLAB. Again, it's just a trade-off of design, look and feel, ease.
But like
right?
I said, I mean, this is still under construction.
Yeah.
So anything you want to share with me, this is a very good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Jim, one more comment?
Yeah, I think another thing, a lot of us have built these things and we tend to build the grand and glorious interactive demo. And I think one of the things I know that Rich is playing with is trying to do very simple things that only demonstrate one thing and then having hundreds of them.
Also. Right, exactly.
Lots of them, rather than some of the ones that have been built in the past, which tend to do everything. And maybe even
Yeah. These are fairly...
There's a lot of bells and whistles going on, and features that some users don't necessarily see.
Yeah, I just
want to comment on a couple of things. One of the things that Mark and I learned in sort of test driving these with a class is that if you put a demo up like this that says, you know, here's two or three sliders, you can slide them around and see what the effect of these different parameters is, our students almost never gain the understanding that we're trying to show by just randomly moving the slider. Right? They don't look at it and go, oh, well, now I see this pattern and I see that pattern. They move the sliders around and they kind of change it. I don't know why. And so we really... When you put a simulation like this out there for them to play with, you really need some kind of instruction that says, first you need to do this, and then you need to do this, and you need to look for this effect, and then you need to answer this question about whether or not you understand what you just saw. And so you have to sort of build it into some kind of guidance that goes with the simulation. You really can't just put the simulation out there and say, see, you'll know if you move the sliders around. That's not what happens. So that was an important thing that we just kind of learned in putting that out there.
So it's basically thinking of these not as just a standalone active figure, but really as a laboratory that the student needs to sort of actively engage in some kind of activity while they're doing it.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, a video or something. I mean, there's a lot of ways to think about that, but there needs to be some guidance.
Yeah.
So we did some work, a long time ago on MicroWorld, what they were called. And one of the important things is that you actually built in a coach. So it's not so much just building a simulation, not just building environment, but actually building an entire curriculum in there, building an entire one semester lab in there with a coaching mechanism that tells students you have to do this. And if they want to take measurements using the markers on their scope and the sensitivity is off, you have to tell them when they try to do it, this is not right. And this is what you did wrong, you should do this and this and this. So you actually need a fairly elaborate system behind the scenes that guides students into actually understanding what it is they're doing.
Right, there has to be a way for them to know, I saw the things you were trying to show me.
And that should come with help and everything. Right? So if they try to do something and you tell them what you didn't do it right, you forgot to do this and this and this, you should have a pointer to, you know, some course material somewhere that explains to them what it is they did wrong, why they did it wrong, and how they could have done it better.
You were commenting earlier about functions, and I just want to point out that we saw some of this in a workshop that we did. One of the neat things you can do in MATLAB if you want to present the work that you've done is you can publish it to a web page. And then there's actually a function that you can get the code from that web page that produces the web page back out into MATLAB. So you can basically say, here's what I did. Now you can grab the code and you can tinker with it. And so it's not exactly the interactive running of the web page, but it is a way.
Anything else before we move on? Jim?
So one thing we experimented with on this point with GUIs like this, the ones we built in MATLAB, is how could you record everything that the user did? And that would be a great capability to get from the vendors. So that would be some way to just say, here's the stream of things that happened. And of course, I don't know what that means because it could be a lot of different things. But then you could analyze that.
That's actually essential for the teaching experience, because what you will find is if students, if you tell them, if you gauge their progress, right, if you say you can't move on unless you've completed this correctly, what you'll find is they'll just muck with things and then okay, until they succeed. So you need to have a way to be able to trace what they did during lab to see whether they really understood it or whether they just sitting there trying all different permutations and then move on. What we ended up doing was we set up a centralized database and we'd stream all the dialogue messages that were presented to the student as they were doing the lab with timestamps and everything.
Better move on. Okay, so let's keep going. So another area, okay, so we've talked about the lecturing, we've talked about the textbook, we talked about the lab. So now what about the homeworks, right, and exams? So there's been a number of projects actively engaged in developing databases of questions and answers to for the purposes of storing, but then also sharing on a much broader base than on an institutional basis. And these question and answer databases have a lot of applications, self-assessment problems for students so that they can understand how well they're doing in the class, automated homework systems that take a lot of the pressure off graders and instructors for grading homework, and also provide immediate feedback to the student on whether they did a problem correctly or incorrectly, which has been proven, again, to enhance learning when you have immediate feedback rather than the usual, at least at Rice. 2 weeks later, you get the homework back graded. So I'll just mention two databases that are being developed. The first and largest was started by Jim McClelland. It's the signal processing question and response system at Georgia Tech. They have actually well over 1,000 problems, right, Jim, I think? Signal processing problems by a number of different faculty at Georgia Tech. We at Rice are developing a cousin of this that we call a quad base. It just has a slightly different architecture. But the good thing is that using web standards like QTI, which is think of it like the HTML or the XML for marking up problems and answers, it's going to actually be very quite straightforward once all the details are worked out to move the problems back and forth between different databases and also directly into your learning management system, right? If you use a Blackboard or a Moodle or an et cetera. And moving forward, over the next few years, we're going to see, just like we just talked about a second ago, ways and means to track student progress as they work through their homeworks, as they work through not just a semester course, but through their entire curriculum. And both Jim's group and my group and a number of other folks are actually actively starting to work on intelligent tutoring systems, coaching systems for teaching people signal processing that can either be used distance ed-like, separated from an actual instructor, or in the context of a regular class. Just some couple screenshots. Here's what SPQR looks like. It presents the problem, lets the student see where they are in the course and how they're doing, right, like with a dashboard here at the top. So it's very much a course organized. QuadBase, on the other hand, is just intended to be super lightweight place for community to develop and share questions, right, and under these Creative Commons licenses. Okay, so this is the two databases, but I know there are some other people working on similar kinds of ideas. So any comments? Wayne, any comments? Audience comments about databases? We're a minute and a half over. Okay, good. Okay. Just one question then. How many people here would use problems if they were up on a database instead of inventing their own? Okay. How many people here would contribute one of their own problems? Okay, how many people would be, here's the big one, How many people would be worried if the answers were also up there publicly available? Only a few people worried. Okay. So,
one thing I would say about that, it's not hard to actually take these problems and change them to where the answer is not available.
Exactly.
So it's, I view it as an inspiration tool as opposed to
Good point. Okay, well, let's plow ahead. The last key element is, how do we deal with the, just imagine all these people in our community developing all this diverse set of educational resources, right? Diversity means what? All kinds of levels of quality. So how are we going to conduct some kind of evaluation of these materials? And if you, I think people have read this as quickly as I can read it. So how do we bring in some of the mechanisms that we use and are very familiar with in the IEEE, in particular peer review? How do we bring in some of these mechanisms that are used for gauging quality? But then how do we also balance the exclusivity of peer review with what we'd really like to be something more community-based or inclusive? And so what we've done in a project in collaboration of SP Society and Connections is to develop a set of what we call lenses, which is essentially a peer review system for materials in Connections. It could also be applied to simulations, could be applied to these video tutorials, could be applied to this question answer database. And the basic idea behind it, how it works, is this big blue disk here is the entire Connections repository of 18,000 modules and all of these textbooks. There's little kids' readers in here. There's really good signal processing stuff. There's maybe really bad signal processing stuff. So what SP Society has set up is a lens. And a lens is simply a web portal. There's the address. If you go to IEEECNX.org, you will get to look into Connections. But you will only see the stuff in Connections that the IEEE, right, the SP Society, has actually evaluated and put their stamp on. Does this make sense to everybody? Okay, so just to give you a sense of how this works, let's say you're in Google, you want to learn about detection theory, you type in detection theory, you end up in this Connections module, right? It happens to be written by Don Johnson. You don't know Don, you don't know if it's any good, could be crappy, right? But if you notice over here, there's a little lens panel that says that this material has been endorsed by the SP Society. When you click on that link, it actually takes you to the list of all of the materials that have undergone this quality evaluation by the SP Society, and you see Don's piece of material here. Right? So you can think of this as a really parallel kind of concept to the editorial boards and journals, is to develop this idea of a lens to point into high-quality content into Connections. And we've actually built a open-source version of Manuscript Central, if you will, that enables us to handle all the administration behind this quality evaluation. Okay, there's a SP Ad Technical Committee has a subcommittee that you can think of as the editorial board for this particular peer review process. And I think there's really two important things that we're trying to do here. The first is help you, the user, find the high quality stuff. And the second is you as a potential author being able to earn the endorsement of IEEE so that we can move towards a world where educational materials have some of the same kind of cachet as usual conference and journal publications, sort of blurring the lines between those things. Any comments about this? I know we're a couple minutes over. What time is it?
5 over now.
No comments. Okay, so let me just end by saying there's actually a project started by a number of us called the Signal Processing Education Network is actually trying, with NSF, National Science Foundation support, and IEEE collaboration, to pull together all of these ideas. And it's a collaboration between Rice, Georgia Tech, UTEP, and Rose Hulman Institute of Technology. And we're really trying to experiment with all of these different elements and bring them together into one system where everything is then, again, quality reviewed by the IEEE. I invite everyone to participate through the IEEE project, the links at the bottom, contributing your materials, also becoming a peer evaluator, much like being a reviewer on a paper, and also invite you to join the SPEN project. We intend to grow this nationally and internationally over the next few years. There's a workshop scheduled on the 20th of September at Georgia Tech, and if you'd like to participate, you're welcome, and please get in touch either with Jim or Jim McClellan or myself for more information on that. And so with that, we probably should end in case we have a couple last questions or comments.
I hope you've enjoyed this and gotten as much out of it as I have. I want to have some more discussion. If you want to talk about this stuff more, we're going to go out there so that the next session can start in here. But thank you very much, Rich.
Thanks.